I think that we could establish certain rules in which more power be given to the Secretary General regarding peacekeeping and peacemaking operations.
Diego Garcia Sayan was the UN Special Rapporteur on the Independence of Lawyers and Judges from 2016 to 2022. Prior to this, he performed numerous roles within the UN, was a judge on the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, and held positions in the government of his native Peru. In this interview, with the IBA's Director of Content, he discusses major rule of law themes, including his involvement in peace negotiations in Latin America, reform of the UN, the importance of the UN's 2030 sustainability agenda, and how to protect the independence of lawyers and judges.
You've held a lot of senior positions in governments, as a judge and with the United Nations. I wonder if you could talk in similar terms really about any highlights or things that stand out for you through that period.
I would say that this reaction against intolerance and the fact of polarization has many signals in human history. One of them is internal strifes, internal wars. So when I had the opportunity, I was very young, in the early 90s, to participate as advisor with a UN team that was handling the peace negotiations to finish with internal wars in Guatemala and in El Salvador. I began to participate in that process thinking that many of the things that were being discussed were impossible to finally achieve an agreement. Because you were speaking with people that were in different sides in wars, in internal war, in battles in which people were being killed. So when one was wording how to reform the army, how to transform the judiciary or build a new police, that sounded a kind of utopia. So finally, I discovered that there are possibilities, good offices that can transmit from one side to the other, the good things from the other, not hiding the bad things, but giving preference to the good thing. And finally, a fantastic peace agreement got built in El Salvador, signed in 1992. And that was while Javier Pérez de Cuellar was Secretary General of the UN. But after that, when Boutros Boutros-Ghali was Secretary General, he appointed me as his representative to monitor the peace agreements in El Salvador. So I transported there with my family, 1,500 people, civilians, police, and military. And a big transformation took place, not because of me or the UN, because that was.
Do you feel the UN
agreement
is as effective as it can be? Does it need to be reformed?
Well, the UN is what we have, We should protect and defend the UN because it's the only world forum that exists. With, of course, a lot of limits that have to do first with other sources of power that compete. Governments, states that are very, very important that didn't exist when the UN was created more than 70 years ago. A world in which when new critical situations appear, like what is happening now in Ukraine, the rules in the Security Council designed after the Second World War at this stage impede a concrete effective action by the United Nations, and in which one seems that many of the matters of the world agenda are not being handled strongly by the UN, not because they are weakly conducted, but because this thing is the big power of the media, the big power of fake news and all things that are not because news should be controlled, of course, but because how to rule this is a lot of things that nobody has yet discovered what is the best thing to do. But in any case, of course, I would say the UN should need some reform, not only in the basic rhetorical thing that let's change the composition of the permanent members of the Security Council, that perhaps is a thing very difficult to happen. But I think that the UN should focus more clearly in all of its areas.
Do you rule out reconstituting the Security Council?
That's a long debate, because it's, of course, I agree with many other people that say, well, there should be more permanent members. No? From Latin America, this permanent name of Brazil occurs. No? But I think that besides that, which is, of course, a matter that should be considered, I am not sure it is viable. No? Mm-hmm. But I think that eventually we should rethink what are the role of the Security Council and rethink it realistically. Mm-hmm. Perhaps the Security Council is not in position to stop all wars. Let's be realistic. What are the conditions in which a peacemaking or a peacekeeping operation should be designed? I would say certain areas, perhaps to be realistic, maintaining the veto power, which is very difficult to change, I think that we could establish certain rules in which more power be given to the Secretary General regarding peacekeeping and peacemaking operations,
right,
with a kind of budget and of allocation of troops, you know, that can eventually have more flexibility for the UN as institution, and not passing what is happening right now. There's no possibility to build a peacekeeping operation because governments don't give the troops, don't give the money.
Yeah.
How can you solve that in a context in which there is money in the world? No? So I think that's a rethinking of the UN that I am not blaming the countries, but the responsibility is mainly in the member states, and especially in the five permanent members of the Security Council.
I'm interested in how influential the UN's 2030 Sustainable Development Agenda has been.
For me as rapporteur, it has been that the crucial way to handle all different matters, you know? Because I can have a report on bar association, a report on judges, a report on prosecutors, on in many other aspects, but there's a kind of basic structure, which is how we need all these components to be part of a goal that has been established by the UN, 2030 Sustainable Agenda, that has to do with all of these components, which at the end of the day has one main value and concept that is the base of all of this: access to justice. Access to justice in a context, as I mentioned in my last report, in which 6 billion people are out of any system of justice in the world. No? And we are living as if justice exists. It just doesn't exist for many, many people, and many others have no access to an independent justice. No? So a sustainable goal 2030, you can speak about a lot of details about the justice, but the first is access, and it has to do with goals, specific goals with connected to budget, access to technology, private investment. Of course, if you need access to internet worldwide, some sort of private involvement should be, and that has in a way exploded during the pandemic, no? In which was more or less obvious that when the courts were closed, with the access was only through internet, there was a kind of two worlds. No? The worlds that in which people and lawyers had access to internet, and now the situation in rural areas in Bolivia, Peru, Nigeria, or elsewhere, and not even lawyers had access to internet or even judges. No? So it's concerned to be dramatic the way in which exclusion has to do not mainly with law, with procedures that can be always improved, but with the allocation of resources, in which it's very unusual that governments give a sort of priority to these expenses. Mm-hmm. I have been minister in two governments, and nobody pays too much attention to this, because I think that has no solution at the end of the day. No? But you need strong courts in access, which means at this stage of the world, technology. It's very easy to have access to a file if you have the procedures, but you need a little bit of money for that. So I think stating now at this stage that 2030 sustainable goals, sustainable development goals, it has to do among the things, it's access and participation of society, the legitimacy of society in which the credibility of transparent procedure of appointment, transparent procedure of evaluation, in which, of course, there will always be complaints. Procedures will always be long. Mm-hmm. People that lose, they will always accuse the other of bribery. But in any case, something will finish. Some procedure will finish. So I am confident that if that concrete goals are established, some results could come, but we need much more pressure on that.
You were appointed to the role towards the end of 2016, and since then we've seen a specific moment, really, with populist nationalism sweeping across the globe. How influential do you feel that's been in terms of independence or lack of independence of lawyers and judges?
Absolutely crucial, because that has been a major source of new threats, no? Not because that kind of policies were also completely new, no? But much more consistent, much more spread. You know? Some countries that began to go in reverse. No? Let's think in Latin America. No? There's a president there that has dismissed the Constitutional Court, appointed another one without any minimum idea of transparency. Nobody cares. There has been no reaction at all. Why? Because there is some support, some political support for these measures, considering that these are part of a process to reduce crime in El Salvador. So I think that this kind of combo, no? Authoritarian populism, mm-hmm. is one of the major actual threats in different parts of the world, in this kind of messianic leaders, no? Which is not new in politics, but what is in a way new is that this combo of authoritarianism and populism that unfortunately has in some countries certain internal social support. So the world should pay attention to that, because the way through which in the past history of 20th century, many very negative processes for the world peace.
What can states do to protect the independence of lawyers and judges?
Well, I think there are a lot. The agenda is very big. Mm. What you say, beginning with a stronger budgetary support, give the judiciary the role it deserves as one of the key components of the democratic society, mm-hmm. which means not only budget. No, perhaps there is no way that the big budget increase can be spread all around the world, but allocating the power they deserve. In their decision, the respect of the rules of judges, no? and the function of lawyers. No? I think that access to justice, no? which is part of the solution, no? You need, in a way, to promote the strengthening of the legitimacy of the judicial process and the legal system, to show that thing works. Mm-hmm. I would say there is a need of a major discussion of how to improve the selection and appointment process, in which not only in authoritarian contexts, but also in democratic contexts, we should rethink until what extent governments, parliaments, senates should be involved in the decision and selection processes of high courts. I have personally my doubts. I don't think that would be that is the best procedure. I don't have a model. Mm-hmm. I made a report on judicial councils as a thing in which you can bring all together different institutions of society and make a selection process more objective without political involvement. But at the same time, I am aware that very strong, legitimate, and democratic judiciaries exist in countries like Germany, in which there is no judicial council at all.